Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
I think he finds blood kind of gross.
Yeah.
It's a real willfulness to get from one problem to the next problem. Mm-hmm. You don't think, he's thinking, okay, well, I've done that. And then he's making mistakes. He leaves a whole trail of mistakes, really. And then we hope that he covers up those mistakes. And we don't know at certain points, will he? And so the audience are going, oh my God, don't forget that. So we're really led into that with him.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Awardist, where we are chatting with the actors, creators, and more who are contenders this year and breaking down the state of the 2024 Emmys race. I'm Entertainment Weekly Executive Editor Jared Hall, and joining me again this week is EWTV critic Kristen Baldwin. Hello again.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fantastic, thanks. I love that we're making this quite the regular affair here, because there's so much to talk about. We've been breaking down predictions over the past few weeks, and there's just so much going on. Some new shows debuting that are kind of taking folks by surprise and leaping into the race, I guess you could say. But today's episode, we are focusing a little bit later on a show that did already debut, a show that Kristen and I have talked about a bit over Slack as we were watching. It's just a beautiful series, and the star of this show did such a phenomenal job. I'm talking about Ripley and its star, Andrew Scott. So stick around for that interview a bit later. Kristen, that show, it's just... I got to say, when they announced it, I didn't expect it to be in black and white, and I absolutely love that it is. Italy in black and white is so mysterious, which is so perfect for this series.
It's so beautiful, and I, you know, at first I was like, why are they redoing this? You know, we've seen this movie, literally, but it just pulled me in, and he's so good. And even though it gets off to kind of a slow start, it's so beautiful to look at. I was just mesmerized. And then once the story gets going, yeah, I had to watch it all essentially in one weekend.
Yeah, I'm with you on it feeling a little slow at first, because we're just kind of observing Tom Ripley and his life and how he operates and how he scams people in starting out in 1950s New York, but then the action moves. So I really kind of enjoyed that spending time with him and getting to know him and how he ticks and all of that. I think it's really important to the psychology of the character, but it's just beautiful and stunning. So that interview is coming up a bit later. Before we get to that, and before we get into more predictions and stuff here today, I want to make sure that all of you listening here know that we have a phone line where you can call in, leave us a message or question, whatever it might be related to what you're hearing us talk about here. And FYI, we might play those messages during an episode. So here is that number, 657-799-1566. 657-799-1566. And if you missed that, you can find it in the description of the episode on whatever podcast platform where you are listening. All right. So, Kristen, last week we had predictions for lead actor and actress in a comedy, drama, and limited or anthology series. We're going to get into the supporting contenders here in just a second. But before we do that, I want to talk a bit about how you really know that Emmy season has really started, because the various studios start having these events, these press events and Q&As with all of their stars. Universal Studios Group has had theirs. Amazon Prime Studios, they've had theirs. At the Universal one, I found it so interesting. By the way, there were casting creators of a lot of shows there, including Hacks, Loot, Girls 5 Eva, based on a true story. Ted, Seth MacFarlane was there. George Lopez for Lopez versus Lopez. They all came out to chat with the press. And I had a really interesting conversation with one showrunner. I'm not going to name names, but this person acknowledged how voters don't watch the shows that they are supposed to be, you know, then checking off names on a ballot, that they go with the familiar names. But this person also agreed with, Kristen, what you and I have been saying about how this year, given the many shows that are not in contention, that voters really do have a chance to recognize some, so to speak, some fresh blood. So yes. I on one hand, it's nice to hear some validation about what we talk about here, but also a little frustrating to know that people on that side are fully aware of how the system works.
Yeah, and certainly we all know that it's impossible to watch everything, and it's impossible to, you know, give a thorough screening to every possible contender. But I do think, you know, ideally you like television if you're a voter, and that right. you will do your best to try to yeah. See as much as you can, especially things that are, you know, new to the race or at least in the mix right. for the first time. But it's good also that the talent out there, you know, whether it's on camera or behind the scenes, know that they're sometimes yes. Not dealing with a level playing field.
Right. I mean, this showrunner was like, I would just like at least love to see a billboard with the star of my show on it. And by the way, the star of his show is one who's, you know, been around for quite a while, and he has a lot of fans in town. So I do tend to agree in some regards that, like, I feel like if you splash this person's face and name around a bit more, they might actually have a shot. Of course, these are campaigns, and campaigns are run by money. So there's mm-hmm. also that to think about. Yeah. And I teased a little earlier that we have some new entries in the race, one that could really shake things up. It is the show everybody is talking about, the Netflix limited series, Baby Reindeer. Richard Gadd created, wrote, and stars in the series, which is based on his own life, but all the names have been changed. He plays a bartender and I guess we can call him a wannabe comedian named Donnie Dunn. Jessica Gunning plays a woman named Martha Scott who begins to stalk Donnie. Kristen, I found this series absolutely fascinating. Like, I started watching it Saturday, and I had to take a break because I had just had some things to go do, but I could not wait to get back home and press play again, because this series is absolutely captivating. It hooks you. You have to know what's going to happen. At first it's funny, but then quickly turns sad and dark. I'm curious your take on it.
Yeah, my take is pretty similar. You know, I started watching it. I had been warned that, you know, look, this is a tough watch. And so I kind of went into it, you know, steeled for that. And it's true. It's, you know, incredibly grim. It deals with, you know, stalking, grooming, sexual assault. But it is also a story that is wholly original, in part, you know, because it is this man's story, or a fictionalized version of his story. But I really, I couldn't not watch it. I was like, okay, this is not necessary. I'm not necessarily, quote unquote, enjoying this because it's so dark and grim, but I need to know what happens. And, you know, by the end of the weekend that I binged it, you know, I just feel like it shot to number one on Netflix. And, you know, friends who do not even cover television, aren't in this industry, were telling me that they were talking about it at their office, you know. So I definitely think it just became a, you know, sort of overnight word of mouth hit. And I think it's, you know, going to make a big impression on the limited series race.
Indeed. Yeah. You know, it's funny. You never really know how especially how an international series is going to catch on. I'm even thinking about how Fleabag kind of had that really quick, like I heard a couple friends talking about it, and then it's like all anyone was talking about. But yeah, this is one, you know, I don't really know how that, if it's an algorithm thing that is what, you know, really got people into this, but it's seven episodes. So it's, and they're fairly short episodes. I say fairly short. They're not hour longs, but they're all in the, I don't know, 30 to 40 minute range mostly. So it's quote unquote easy to watch in those regards, but right from content perspective, not easy at all. I did not know how dark it was going to get, Kristen. So
yeah,
as episode, I guess it was end of two, beginning of three. I was like, oh, I think this show is not what I was expecting. And yeah, it there are definitely some moments that I was just like literally jaw agape, and like tears, you know, you could feel them welling up. I was like, oh my God, this is just, it's really something else. So I'm going to put out into the universe, we hope to be able to speak with Richard and Jessica at some point here on the podcast. I know it's certainly not an easy subject matter for them to really talk about, especially for Richard. This is his real life. But I hope we're able to have that conversation with them here on the podcast in the coming weeks. All right. So that aside, and we might hear one of those names here as we start to get into these contenders and nomination predictions. Let's break down the supporting categories, the supporting acting categories for drama, comedy, and limited series. Kristen, let's get into drama supporting actress first. There were 8 nominees in this category last year, which, by the way, were, I think, 5. If not 6, were held by actresses from The White Lotus. So considering that we don't have season 3 of that show yet, it really opens things up here. So Kristen, take it away with your nomination predictions.
All right. So I have Elizabeth Debicki from The Crown, Leslie Manville, also from The Crown, Christine Baranski from The Gilded Age, also Cynthia Nixon from The Gilded Age, Kristen Scott Thomas from Slow Horses, Greta Lee from The Morning Show, Nicole Beharie from The Morning Show, and Holland Taylor from The Morning Show. So The Morning Show and The Crown and The Gilded Age, you know, not too many, 3 shows dominating as opposed to just that one.
Right. It gets interesting with you kind of saying her name, Christine Baranski. We have been like for years trying to get this woman in for The Good Fight, and it never happened for that one. But gosh darn it, The Gilded Age, she is just so great on that show. Worth noting, Elizabeth Debicki has she won at the SAG Awards, and I believe it was also the Golden Globes. Do you think this one's hers to lose?
I do. I think she did a great job as Diana. And obviously this final season, you know, was chronicling Diana's romance with Dodi Fayed and also her her death, of course. And, you know, I don't think people are going to hold ghost Diana against her. It wasn't her fault that, you know, the writers had her return as ghost Diana after her character passed away. But I think she was so good. I think it is hers to lose at the moment, but, you know, who can say?
That is true. So many factors can shake up this race. Are any others kind of on the fringe who you think might get in, or someone who you would love to see get in?
Well, I'd love to see Audra McDonald get in for The Gilded Age. And I'm also throwing a Hail Mary out there for Amy Ryan, who's in Sugar. I feel like, you know, she's good in Sugar. She's really, you know, she has a great role and she does a good job. But I also feel like she's retroactively owed an Emmy for The Wire and The Office and in Treatment. So, you know, that's my hope.
Yeah, she's I don't know that Amy Ryan has ever turned in a bad performance. We'll put it that way. She's so good in everything. Yeah. All right. Let's turn our attention to the supporting actors in a drama. Kind of the same situation. White Lotus occupied several of the slots here last year, but they are not around. So who do you have this time?
Well, some more gentlemen from The Morning Show, including Billy Crudup, John Hamm, Mark Duplass, and then we have Jonathan Pryce and Khalid Abdallah from The Crown, Benny Safdie from The Curse, Kihei Kwan from Loki, and Nathan Lane from The Gilded Age.
Okay, I don't even know where to begin with this category. It's such a, I mean, Billy Crudup has won here before, but I don't know. My hands are, I'm in like the shrug emoji position for this one.
I mean, I wouldn't be mad at kind of any of these. I guess I would say, you know, I don't know that I feel like John Hamm's performance in The Morning Show really, like, you know, knocked my socks off.
Rises.
I would probably be, my choice would be Benny Safdie. I thought he was so good in The Curse, playing a sort of sleazy and
very, yeah,
depressed reality TV producer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think maybe they go back to Billy Crudup just because, you know, it's clearly the morning show is going to have a lot of nominations this year, in yeah. part because there are a lot of openings and people continue to love that that show. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's anyone's race right now.
Mm-hmm. Who would you like really love to see get in?
Well, the person that I would love to get nominated, and I, as I say in the post, that I am just screaming into the void here, but Chris Bauer was so good in Heels, which is the wrestling drama on Stars. He played Wild Bill Hancock, an abrasive reformed sleazeball wrestler turned wrestling scout, and he was just so funny and you know, he emotionally, you know, a really deep and rich performance on top of being funny with this really like sort of ridiculous character. He's so great. You know, all the way back to The Wire, he's been so good. I would love to see all roads lead to The Wire, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, give Chris Bauer an Emmy. Thank you.
He's one of those guys who I feel like is just criminally underrated, and he needs his moment. So maybe this will be it, Kristen. Maybe the voters are listening and paying attention. We can only hope. So we're going to jump to supporting actress in a comedy series. We have 7 potential nominees here. Who are you going with?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you just got to go with Meryl Streep, who was in Only Murders in the Building this season. I mean, you don't not nominate her when she's in anything. No. Then we've got some ladies from Abbott Elementary, including Cheryl Lee Ralph, Janelle James, and I think this year Lisa Ann Walter might make it in. Hannah mm-hmm. Einbinder from Hacks, Abby Elliott from The Bear, and also Liza Colon Zayas from The Bear.
So this one gets interesting because Cheryl Lee Ralph won for season 1 of Abbott, and then Ayo Edebiri won for season 1 of mm-hmm. The Bear. But since she has moved to lead actress, that I would have thought she could have easily, Ayo, could have easily won again here for season 2. Mm-hmm. But things, I feel like, kind of open up a bit. But do you feel like we might hear a new name this year, someone who's not won in this category?
I mean, I think Abby Elliott had a great season on The Bear. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see Lisa Ann Walter get in as yeah. well. You know, there was that funny post last time around when she was eating her feelings because she didn't get nominated.
Yes.
You know,
she, yes.
And you know, which very relatable. So you know, and you know, there's no Ted Lasso, so we, you know, the Juno right. Temple and Hannah Waddingham slots are open. Alex Borstein, you know, 5-time nominee in this category, mm-hmm. also not eligible. So I would love to see all these. All these folks. I mean, other names in the mix, Carol Burnett, Paul from Palm Royale, yeah. Molly Gordon, also from The Bear, Polina Alexis from Reservation Dogs. I love her so yeah. much. And I'm throwing, you know, putting out into the universe, Megan Stalter from Hacks. So good. I can't even say her name without laughing. She's so good yeah. as Jimmy's chaotically terrible assistant, Kayla.
Yeah. Assistant turned, I guess, business partner, right? Because
true.
They're kind of doing that thing now with her trust fund. She has some great stuff this season, but I do also got to say, I think Hannah Einbinder season 3, which has not come out yet, May 2nd. I don't know how much we can say, but I will just say I think she's never been better on
yeah.
the show.
Agreed.
Some really great stuff. So this is going to be a tough, tough category. But I agree with you on all of your choices here for nominees, and I hope they all get in there. I do think Lisa Ann Walter's overdue for Abbott as well. So
yeah, I'd love to see her get in there.
All right. So moving on to supporting actor in a comedy. Last year's winner is, of course, in the mix again. Several folks from The Bear. So give us your list.
So we have Ebon Moss-Bachrach from The Bear, Lionel Boyce from The Bear, Oliver Platt graduating to supporting from The Bear, mm-hmm. Tyler James Williams at Abbott Elementary, Bowen Yang and Kenan Thompson from Saturday Night Live, and Paul Rudd, Only Murders in the Building.
Yeah, so this one also opens up because of Ted Lasso not being in the mix, as well as Barry had some slots here. I think just based on last year with Eben winning, I feel like I'm leaning toward him again this year. But do you think someone else could slide in? Is Tyler James Williams overdue?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I think Eben won. He was great in season one, but season two, people had just watched that with Forks.
Right.
You know, certainly his showcase episode. I feel like if people are reminded that this was the year that, you know, he gave an even more, you know, captivating performance, it would be hard to deny him. But yeah, I mean, it's a great group again, and you kind of can't be mad at any of the winners.
No, I wouldn't be upset at any of those at all. But, you know, I posed the question, is it Tyler James Williams' time to win? My question is it Chris Perfetti's time just even to get nominated? I love him so much on there dealing with, you know, infusing like anxiety into all of his comedy. And I think he does it so well on Abbott.
Yeah, he is really great. And so, you know, I think this is a cast that, you know, it's hard to get them all nominated in one year, but here's hoping that he sneaks in there. Because he's definitely in the mix as well.
Yeah, that could be quite a feat. How many of those folks we get in there. Okay, moving on to limited or anthology series or movie. Kicking off here with the actress contenders as well. You've got a list of seven. Who are they?
Callie Reese from True Detective Night Country, Jennifer Jason Leigh from Fargo, Chloe Sevigny from Feud, Capote versus the Swans, Diane Lane from Feud, Capote versus the Swans, Asia Naomi King from Lessons in Chemistry, Sandra Oh from The Sympathizer, and Lily Gladstone from Under the Bridge. Also bubbling up as of, you know, this past weekend, Jessica Gunning from Baby Reindeer.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting to see how Jessica shakes things up in this category. What's so fascinating here, and potentially a little, I'd say with my fingers twiddling, like scandalous, but not necessarily scandalous, but like how many of the actresses from Feud are really going to get in? Because there are several. It's a great cast, but I think it's going to be perhaps a small number.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode where, you know, people aren't able to watch everything and they just check off names that they know. These are names they know. Calista Flockhart, Diane Lane, Chloe Sevigny, obviously Naomi Watts, who's in the lead category. Demi Moore would probably, I think, count as guest because I don't think although she might be in supporting, I'm not sure. So yeah, these are very well-known names. But certainly there are also other big names that are in the mix as well, including Dakota Fanning from Ripley. So this is a pretty jam-packed category as per usual.
Yeah. All right. So then that brings us to supporting actor in a limited or anthology series or a TV movie where – holy cow, looking at this list already, there are some incredible performances here. So who do you have making the final cut, Kristen?
The early final cut before the real final cut,
yes,
but the
exactly.
current final cut. Got to go with Robert Downey Jr. from The Sympathizer. He plays multiple roles, and he's Robert Downey Jr., so of course. Mm-hmm. Joe Keery from Fargo, Jonathan Bailey, Fellow Travelers, Lewis Pullman from Lessons in Chemistry, John Hawks from True Detective Night Country, the late, great Treat Williams from Feud, Capote versus the Swans, and Tadanobu Asano from Shogun.
Oh my gosh, Shogun is so good. It's so, so good.
So good.
This cast, that all of them are just absolutely incredible. Robert Downey Jr., we've talked about here in previous weeks, he's in that same boat as Emma Stone, where he could be an Emmy and an Oscar winner in the same year. To your point, yes, of course, he's Robert Downey Jr. I don't think he's going to have a problem getting nominated. But adding to the thought that he could actually win, exactly what you said, this isn't just one role, it's multiple characters he plays, and he's kind of almost unrecognizable in some of them. Do you feel like he has an edge here because of the year he's had?
Absolutely. You know, like you said, because just like Emma Stone also has an edge, I think she's, you know, top of mind from Oscars, yeah. And Poor Things, and she's going to go right into this, you know, in terms of campaigning. So I think, you know, and also just like people love him. They know he'll give a good speech.
Yeah, that's true.
I would love to see Treat Williams get it. He was only nominated once before. And he is really good. He plays William Paley in Feud, and he's really, really good. And just his final role. And
yeah,
I would love to see him win that posthumous award. But, you know, it's going to be hard to beat Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah. I know you have one of these guys in the mix, but a question that several people have asked me who've seen the series is, will Masters of the Air get Emmy nominations, any of those guys? And you do have one of them right now as a potential.
Yes, Barry Keoghan from Masters of the Air. And that's one that, you know, could slip in with more surprise, or not necessarily surprise, but more in more slots, because it was, you know, I think a very successful series in terms of viewership. I don't know that it, mm-hmm. you know, really set the world on fire in terms of the zeitgeist and people talking about yeah. it. But, you know, some strong actors in there as well. And it's not like Apple doesn't have money to launch a vigorous exactly. Emmy campaign. So Barry could be one of several.
Right. And Tom Hanks, you know, he's behind mm-hmm. this. So I think that, you know, is going to go a long way with folks as well. But yeah, that'll be interesting to see. I feel like that show could either do nothing or, like you said, it could actually get in several places. But
mm-hmm.
time will tell. Those nominations aren't announced until Wednesday, July 17th. And we're going to keep updating nominations on EW.com as the season goes along. Kristen is keeping her finger on the pulse of everything happening in the conversation there. And we have more nomination predictions in other categories as well at EW.com. So be sure to also check those out. All right. So that is that for now. I want to remind you folks, you can call in, leave your comments, questions, certainly as it pertains perhaps to those predictions we just ran through. That number is 657-799-1566. All right, folks, coming up, Ripley star and producer Andrew Scott, the awardist, will be right back. Welcome back to The Awardist, and I guess that sentiment applies to all of you who are listening, but also to my guest today, Ripley star Andrew Scott. Hello, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How you doing?
I am doing well, thank you. And that welcome back is, of course, because it was just a few months ago you were here on the podcast talking about All of Us Strangers, and now the conversation has shifted to the series adaptation of Ripley, which just congratulations on, because this adapting this book is really no small feat, and I know it was a long shoot for you guys, but it turned out so well.
Yeah, it was an arduous shoot, but yeah, it's great that it's now out in the world, and we're hearing everybody's reactions to it. So that's it's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, tell me about some of those reactions. Any in particular that are kind of, you know, sticking with you?
I think what's very interesting is I think people are really enjoying a kind of different way of watching television, and people talking about the pacing of it a lot. And you know, the show is unusual in the sense that sometimes it moves at quite a slow pace. Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, maybe reluctant to call it a slow pace because that sounds like it's just dull, but it's just that it really focuses on very intrinsic things that might be going on in Tom Ripley's mind, and the tasks, the sort of menial tasks that he has to endure, mm-hmm. and how difficult it is that, possibly to dispose of a body. It's easy to murder someone. I'm not talking from my own personal experience, but I suppose just that this guy is that it's very difficult to do some of the things that he has to do, and that requires time, and that requires the audience's time, and sometimes to really go, and then sometimes it's really fast paced, and sometimes it's very domestic, and so it's very similar, I think, in the way that we might read a novel. You could spend four or five pages over the description of a room or an atmosphere or a person in a novel, and we go into that. And I think it's quite unusual for people to do that in the way we watch television at the moment. And so people are really, really excited by that in some ways. And some people just go, oh my God, no, I want it to be bang, 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 bang. And I love that. I like when there's, I really do think it's important that we have, I think if you make something original, you're always going to have like really disparate sort of opinions on things. And I think that's exciting because it means that you've made something that's new and challenging.
Indeed. Well, I, you know, some of those slow moments I actually really loved because it was just that getting to spend time with the character and get to know him, know his life, how he operates and all of that. But you mentioned those kills. We're going to talk about some of those in a minute because I want to kind of jump back to the beginning, I guess. Did you already know Steven Zellian? Did he reach out directly? Did the call come from your team? Like, how did this all happen? You're getting involved.
I was sent the scripts. I was sent all of the scripts.
All of them. Oh.
I think I had an initial call with Steve Zalian, and then I think I was sent the entirety of the scripts, which is very, very unusual. So I was able to see this, you know, the whole 8 episodes, read them all. I read them, I remember, on a transatlantic flight, and I was completely gripped by them. And they're very, very faithful to the spirit of the books. And I think there's some really brilliant televisual tricks that Steve has created to make it work as a visual story rather than just a literary one. And then we just had a conversation. I said yes, and then we were delayed quite a bit, you know, because we had there was around the time of the pandemic, and the pandemic was kicking off. So it's been a long gestation period.
Steve has said that you were his first choice to play Ripley. Does an actor ever dare ask, why do you want me? Or did you ask?
No, I didn't ask. I did. Steve is a man of a few words, so I didn't think I would. I don't think he would tell me even if I did ask him, but I thought it wise not to ask. And also, you know, sometimes I think it's quite good not to ask what it is that, you know, particularly when you're playing somebody as dark as this, maybe you go like, what did you see in me?
Right.
But no, I think what's interesting about it for me, or the reason that I felt as soon as I read the character, that it was something that was within my gift, because I, you know, it's something I've said a lot about this character. I don't see him as a sociopath, or I don't really see him as a you know, a villain or a monster or any of those things. And I know that, of course, when you're watching it, people are like, oh my God, these extraordinary things that he does. But, you know, when your first job as an actor is to advocate for the character and to try and not judge the character. So I just really understood his sense of loneliness, the extremism, of course, I don't relate to, but, you know, there's something that's so clear to me in the script, which is, this is a man who's on the outskirts of society, really, and he's extremely gifted, he's talented, and he moves in the world completely unseen and unloved and unappreciated, and then he's exposed to these people who are just gifted with so many things, with half the amount of talent that he has. And I think Patricia Highsmith is speculating upon, however consciously, is the distribution of all the beautiful things in the world, and how uneven that can be, and how some people get access to everything and feel entitled to everything, and some people just don't have either the entitlement or the access.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. You mentioned, you know, you're not looking at, I wasn't sure whether he's really falls into sociopath or psychopath, because there are different, you know, clinical definitions. But considering that you didn't look at him that way, that you zeroed in on like the loneliness, did you feel like that was all already there in the script and in Patricia's novels? Or were you even doing research outside of what was, you know, presented to you, what was kind of at your fingertips?
No, I think what's very important to me is not to kind of other these people. I think sometimes when there are famous murderers, for example, serial killers or anything like that, sometimes we can have a very sensationalist way of talking about those people, and we call them monsters. And of course, what they do is horrific, but I think what we have to accept about ourselves is that this is something that human beings do. There's a darkness that at one point these people were little babies and children, and I suppose the first job for me is to just go, well, why would he do that, and what's true? And he's the hero of the piece, but he's a sort of unreliable hero. So in a way, I just didn't want to cloud it with I didn't want to diagnose him with anything too much, really, and just to understand what his secrets are. I think all characters have some sort of secrets, and Tom Ripley particularly does. And in some ways, even in talking about it in the press, I feel like that he's got some secrets that I even still go, oh, well, that's just something that I... So it was very, because he's such an isolated character, there's a lot of stuff that I didn't speak about with anybody, really. So that was a kind of, it was a hard thing. It was a hard kind of energy to carry around, and we shot it for the guts of a year, you know. So there was an awful lot of things within the character. There were an awful lot of different facets to the character, but the psychological kind of singularity of him and the solitariness of the character, I find perhaps the most difficult, because it's not the way I really exist as a human being myself. But also there were lots of, you know, there was a huge amount of just acting. You know, he's in 95% of the scenes in an 8-hour show, and that's actually quite unusual for television. We see it perhaps in movies a wee bit, where there's like one protagonist in every scene. But in television, it's usually about a family or a couple or a police department or something. One character is, you know, we have a huge supporting cast. But a lot of the time I was sort of on my own, and I found that a very particular challenge. And we, you know, I was in a foreign country, it was during COVID, and I had to speak Italian, and there was physical demands of it, you know, shooting 12-hour days every day for a long time with that kind of atmosphere, dark atmosphere, was a very particular challenge. And I'm really glad I experienced it, but it certainly is one that you have to kind of carry around a wee bit.
I cannot even imagine. Yeah. You know, what I find really impressive is how you and Steve and Patricia as well, I suppose, with her original novels, managed to make Ripley someone who you're actually rooting for. Like I remember watching episode 8 and I was sitting on my couch out loud saying, why am I cheering on this guy who has killed 2 people? Like, I want him to evade police. And so I guess my question is, what is wrong with me?
Yeah. Well, that is a whole can of worms. I think that's absolutely her intention, and that's why the character is so enduring. Mm-hmm. And why there have been so many iterations of this character. Mm-hmm. Because there's some part of us, you know, a lot of the time on this, talking about this character, people are like, oh, have you ever met a Tom Ripley type character? And I really do think the more interesting question is, who is the Tom Ripley within us? Because I don't think you're alone in that experience where you're going, where not necessarily that we feel murderous or that we do the things
right,
that we do, but where we feel like that person who's not invited to the party and who's sort of discounted in some way. And I think that's what she's talking about in a little way, that every person contains these multitudes, and sometimes making somebody who does bad things the protagonist is an exciting thing to do, because our heroes are required to be, or, you know, our literary and dramatic heroes are required to be truthful. They're not actually required to be, you know, completely virtuous. That's not, or accessible necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I think when we focus on characters as main characters who are not beautiful and charming and accessible at every given point, I think, well, they're as deserving of stories as everybody else. And so I think there is a certain charm to Tom. But it's not, I don't think he should also be drowned in that either. I think the most important thing for me was just that we ask all the questions, and we make the audience ask all the questions and don't necessarily rush to answer them.
Yeah. Well, speaking of drowning, you kind of set me up perfectly there. Let's talk about the first of those two murders, which is only partial drowning. There's more going on prior to that. But starting with Dickie on the boat, I mean, at first, this thing is pretty brutal, the being beaten with an oar. Yes. But then it takes a bit of wild, absurd, or maybe perhaps the only words I can come up with where it goes from there. But what do you remember most about filming that sequence?
Oh, it was really grueling. It was grueling. Yeah, absolutely. It was. We did a lot of versions of that because we had to do kind of the dialogue section of it. We had to do a lot of tank work. I had to be in the sea. You know, we have to lift rocks. You know, you have to try and get back into a boat from water when you are completely exhausted is completely exhausting. It's difficult to do that, and to do that over and over and over again. And we did a huge amount of coverage on that, as we did with everything in the show. And it took a long time. And you do realize how exhausting that must be. And you know, just doing, you know, 7 or 8 takes where you're lifting up 20 rocks is tiring. So what he must have had to go through, the character, you know, it helps you imagine what that must have been like. But I think it's an extraordinary sequence. I really genuinely think it's completely gripping. And I think there's so much beautiful artistry at work there, because there's atmosphere, but there isn't a huge amount of score. So we really put ourselves in a position where we're watching this man think, we're watching this man make mistakes, we're watching this man really, really scramble, and we see these tiny triumphs within this sequence, and then we see failures, and I think it's very clever in the sense that it leads us to go, God, I really want this person to survive that, no matter who he is, no matter what he's done, because we forget everything about him, we're just looking for this character to survive. And I think for that reason, to set that kind of atmosphere up for the audience allows us to root for him no matter what happens after that. And I think that's why by the end, like you were saying, you just go, okay, well, I don't want to get caught at this thing. Look at all he's been through.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah,
exactly. And so then there's Freddy's death, which, I mean, you know, this isn't like a, you know, one blow to the head and it's done kind of thing. Like it takes a little bit of work on Tom's part. And then, of course, there's getting him out of the apartment. And then there's the weekend at Bernie's situation of it all with carrying him around. But like, grotesque slapstick is kind of a phrase our TV critic and I were kind of talking about when we were talking about this scene. But we're curious, what was Tom thinking as he was dragging Freddy down those stairs and Freddy's head is, you know, like bopping one by one on the way down?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that I've never thought that Tom is bloodthirsty. I think he finds blood kind of gross.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a real willfulness to get from one problem to the next problem. You don't think, he's thinking, okay, well, I've done that. And then he's making mistakes. He leaves a whole trail of mistakes, really. And then we hope that he covers up those mistakes. And we don't know at certain points, will he? And so the audience are going, oh my God, don't forget that. So we're really led into that with him. And, again, that sequence took a long time too. It was beautifully, beautifully framed, almost like a play, you know, where we could see from room to room what he might be doing, and the camera remains at a sort of distance at times. It was shot at night, and or else sometimes we were pretending day for night. There were big sequences, and it is hard to shake that off at the end of the day. You do kind of spend your whole day, you know, repeating a lot of physical stuff, and holding trying to keep a dead body upright is, you know, it's difficult, even though Elliot is a very svelte person.
Well, I was about to ask if it was Elliot the whole time or if there was like a mannequin of any kind swapped in at some point.
It sort of depended. We moved between, obviously, we didn't want to whack Elliot's head against
sure, of course,
terrazzo floors in Italy. Yeah, as much as the camera would allow, if you know what I mean.
Well, and you know, the one person isn't the right word, but the one living being that knows the answers is a cat. That cat, the cat's real name was King, is that correct?
Yeah, King.
King.
Yeah.
King. I mean, as soon as King, I read that, it's just
read
a beauty
that character. I said to Steve, I was like, that cat is a great part. It's a really good for any up and coming cats.
Right, a great example. That cat is going to give 92Y conversations and all that good stuff. But as you though, when you got to look back and see like what they had done, how they had integrated the cat, I mean, that must have been so satisfying to see how those scenes then play with each other.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, I was like looking, I was interacting with an imaginary cat. The cat didn't even turn up for my close-ups.
Wow.
Cat, bit of
wow.
a diva.
Diva, yeah.
Maybe they were double jobbing on some other Italian project. You just use your imagination, don't you? And it's wonderful. I think that's so exciting, the idea that he is being observed by somebody. And it plays a very particular narrative trick because it's so satisfying for the audience to see, make the audience think, is that cat going to tell?
right. Like, how is this going to play out? Yeah.
Is it going to play out? And is the cat, in some ways, you know, it's so interesting. Sometimes I imagine the cat to be Patricia Highsmith herself, but that's just my crazy imagination.
That's fascinating. I did not think of that, but that's really cool. I got to say, watching Tom and Marge was like watching a chess match. Those scenes are so fascinating and also slightly perhaps more menacing because neither of these characters are people who, they don't raise their voice. They're so even-keeled with each other. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, like filming, did you guys film those conversations in any different ways or had it been established early on? This is the way we are talking to each other because it establishes a certain tone
I think they're disguising a huge amount of what they feel, which is always a very interesting thing to act. So, you know, you kill people with kindness, don't you? And you're incredibly polite and you're saying things that the other person absolutely knows they don't really mean in order to sort of maintain some sort of decorum. And that's why the violence in some ways, or the threat of violence even, is so potent, I think, because you think that's there at any point. And so if you're being really nasty to each other or you're shouting or whatever, it's completely unnecessary. And I also think that Marge is suspicious of Tom. But also, Tom is suspicious of Marge. Maybe not for the same reasons. But I love all that sort of interplay where they're talking about being great artists and being writers and painters and all that kind of stuff. And then there's this incredible sequence where they're buying a refrigerator, and he's like, which at the time I suppose is like being really concerned with, you know, your new Wi-Fi package. You know, like it's like. It's so domestic and it's so capitalistic and it's so the opposite of what Tom, I suppose, admires. And he admires the dangers of the artist and Caravaggio. And so there's something that I think he suspects within the two of them. And I think he's not far wrong in the sense that their actual preoccupations are actually quite meek and quite shallow. And that they're actually more interested in safety in some ways than actual artistic expression in the way that they pretend that they are. These free living artists that are living in Italy. These are people who come from money who actually are getting excited about ice trays, and he hates that because it's phony. It's phony, and I think you can say whatever you want about Tom, but. People call him a fake, but actually in some ways he's not a phony because he's not pretending that he's not a phony.
Right. Yeah, he's the most real in those regards, for sure. Mm-hmm. And then I just love the way that suspense is built once we get to Venice and we know about the slippery steps, and I'm like, oh, what's it? Is she going to get hurt? I loved all of that. I was hanging on to every scene when we got to all that. You mentioned speaking Italian, which I understand you learned for this, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah,
but
yeah.
But you had to learn Italian as an American, not as an Irishman. So added level of complexity?
Absolutely. And not actually just to add another thing that I was maybe stupidly thinking, but I also had to imagine, I imagine an American, it's actually two Americans.
Oh.
Because it's an Irishman playing an American speaking Italian. And then it's an Irishman playing an American imitating another American speaking Italian.
Oh, right.
So actually,
right.
So Dickie Greenleaf's Italian would be slightly different to Tom Ripley's Italian, because you'd have a different way of speaking, in the same way some people would be very proficient at speaking Italian and some people would be less so. So, I mean, it doesn't make that huge difference, I don't think. But it's something I definitely thought about. I was like, well, what way would Tom as Dickie speak Italian? Would he be as good, or would he be better? And, yeah, I did think about that. But it was a really fascinating thing to, and very fascinating thing to not act in your own language. You know, it's hard, but it was made easy because obviously I had so many Italian friends on the crew, and you know, I was always asking them, and I was speaking it as you know, I didn't just learn the lines. I really, really had a great Italian teacher who you know, my Italian was, you know, okay, it's pretty okay, I think. I'm not in the show. I mean, just I could understand people. I could speak a little bit, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, your impersonation of Johnny Flynn is quite good. That in the mirror, that entire sequence. Do you feel like you have a good ear though for hearing voices and stuff like that?
I do. I think it's a sort of musicality. I don't know. I suppose I'm not necessarily very good at. I think it's more about like an energy sometimes with people. I feel like you can get the vibe of somebody if you're at dinner with them, and what they're, you know, if their language is, the way they speak language is halting, or their physicality or something. Impersonations necessarily, I don't think you'd be like, oh my God, I can do an incredible impersonation with that. I think for a lot of people, you can do really good impressions of certain people and then not good impressions of other people. And I think it depends on your relationship. Like, people are very good at doing impressions of their parents or their spouse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or their kid, you know, like somebody that they really know, because you're sort of interested in them. So a lot of the time I think that's kind of the challenge. But yeah, that's part of the requirement for me in the actor, as the actor in this one, is to in some ways imitate what Johnny's Dickie was like. But also not just be too slavish to that idea, because I'm not sure that the audience cares too much for that. I don't think that's our number one priority.
Italy, I mean, I feel like there are so many screen grabs you could take of any episode,
yes,
and
they
look like postcards. It's absolutely beautiful and stunning. Was there a location that was more difficult to film in than others, either purely because of, I don't know, like the space, or just hard to get permits or anything like that?
Yeah, well, we filmed in so many different kind of locations. We filmed in Naples, and Naples is sort of wild. It's wonderful. It's such an extraordinary place to stay, and so different from. And then, of course, we were filming in Venice. In January, during the second phase of the pandemic, and that was really, in some ways, I wouldn't say it was difficult, and actually, in some ways, it could have made things a little easier, because there weren't reams of tourists around. I remember very clearly in Venice, walking to work through San Marco Square, and it just been completely empty, which is absolutely wild for Venice in January, because that's usually when the Biennale is on. Just thinking, I'll never, and the rolling mist in the square, and you think, oh my God, I'm the only person here in this world famous square. And that was really extraordinary when I think about it now. And yeah, and then we did a lot of studio stuff in Rome as well. But you know, the locations were beautiful. And then we were in Capri, we were in a tiny little village called Atrani. And so it was so beautiful. And of course, I didn't experience it in black and white. I experienced it in full color.
Right.
So you know, it really is spectacular.
Well, that was about to be my next question. The black and white. What you thought of Steve's choice to go that way? Because it's just, I think it's incredible. But I know, like you said, there are some people who are like, oh, we want to see the colors and the beauty of Italy. But it plays its own kind of role here, of course.
Yeah, and I understand that feeling, and it was certainly a question that I had myself. But I think what's important, you know, when you're, you know, my job is to serve the director's vision for the most part. Obviously, you want to contribute your own ideas too in relation to the character. That's very important. But yeah, there was a question about that, a sort of, you know, I don't think it was a sort of 100% surety that we would be, it would always be black and white. There was a question that, you know, will this work and blah, blah. So I think it was filmed with an idea of like, this could go either way, but certainly, and that is what Steve's vision was. That's what he wanted. And I think it's very important that you try and sort of serve that vision. But I don't think it made too much difference to the acting necessarily. I thought about it in relation to my costumes. I think if you're not going to have color, then you have to have texture, and that sort of stuff is very important to me. And it was certainly a big question for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, last big question I have for you. Steve has said he does want to adapt the other four Ripley novels, but considering the first took 6 years, he's not sure how realistic that is. But given the amount of time it took, and given what you said about, you know, just that kind of dark place you were living in, is that something you'd be down for, revisiting this character that many times over?
It's interesting. I'm not sure if this is the honest answer. As you say, it was such a long gestation period for this to come out, and it's a dark place, and you know, it's I've been thinking of it as a limited series, but I suppose it's something that I'll see. It's very interesting in relation to how things are transmitted into the world now, because it's not like, okay, people watch it in the first week and then you sort of make a decision after the first week. It's sort of, it really, people like, members of my family, I was just talking to this morning, they were like, oh, we're only on episode 3 now. Like, people want to, particularly Ripley, I think. It's not one that, I've sort of really noticed that some people binge watch it, but some people go, no, I'm going to do an episode a night. I'm going to do that. I'm going to just really seep in that atmosphere. And it takes a while for things to, for people to really see it. And, you know, a couple of months maybe. That's the way we sort of watch television now. So I'm just letting it sort of go out there. And almost sometimes the audience teaches you what you've made in a way. You know what I mean? You know, it's hard, particularly for me. I find it difficult to go, well, what is it? What is that? And then you go, well, that's what it means, because it's hard to separate sometimes the product from the process. My instinct at the moment is that it's a limited series, and that's the way I've been thinking about it. But you know, you have to, you know, the world is such a surprising place. You know, I've never said never to anything, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that the truth? Indeed. Yeah. Well, look, if we get more of it, it will be our gift and blessing. But I can say, I think all of you just knocked it out of the park with this. It's some really incredible work. Yeah. Folks, of course, if you didn't already gather, you can watch all of Ripley on Netflix. Andrew Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Kristen, I got to tell you, I am so glad to see Andrew Scott getting his due, getting his star is on the rise. Should have been a long time ago. This guy has just been an incredible performer for years, and the last 6 months or so have just been very kind to him. But I got to say, those scenes with the cat, I don't want to say his greatest scene partner in the show, because he has some great co-stars, but that cat, my gosh, beautiful Maine Coon, who holds the answers to everything.
I know the cat is watching, and like, you know that the cat knows he's up to no good. The way that that cat is a very good actor, because you could tell the cat knew it was watching mm-hmm. something very sus.
Mm-hmm. And the way that, like, the tail is flicking mm-hmm. and yeah. Mm-hmm. But I just thought it was so funny what Andrew said about, like, you wonder, is the cat going to tattletale on me?
Does.
I mean, he kind of perfectly plants that bloody paw print. Mm-hmm. Sorry, perfectly plants that bloody paw print. But you know, of course, the landlady's like, oh, he caught a mouse.
Yeah, it's like, man, like, what do you think he did to that mouse? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But that's what I kind of love about the series, too, is that just when you think like, oh, here we go, this is what's going to be his unraveling, his undoing. And it's not. No. And they keep you hooked that way. And I think such a fun way.
Absolutely. It's just, even if you know the story, it's hard not to just kind of get super invested and start asking yourself, how is he going to get out of this? Right. And you know, I thought he was so good in this role. Give him all the Emmys.
Not just how is he going to get out of this, but why am I rooting for him to get
out of this? Exactly. Good point.
Like I posed to Andrew, like, what is wrong with me that I want a murderer to evade mm-hmm. police? Mm-hmm. But that's, like I told him, that's a topic for a whole other podcast. So the deep psychology of all of us who root for the wrong people as we're watching TV and movies. Mm-hmm. But anyway, if you folks haven't watched it, Ripley is certainly worth your time on Netflix. Well, Kristen, that is it for another episode of The Awardist. Thank you, as always, for joining me.
Always happy to do it.
And thanks so much to all of you for listening. If you like what you're hearing here on The Awardist, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us an award-winning review on Apple Podcasts. And to keep the conversation with us going, you can follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials. We're at EW on X, formerly known as Twitter, and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag me at Jared Hall. We will see you back here next week. The Awardist is an Entertainment Weekly podcast hosted and produced by Jared Hall and produced and edited by Sammy Junio. Thanks for listening. All voicemails become the property of The Awardist. By leaving a voicemail, you give Entertainment Weekly the absolute right to edit, broadcast, display, or otherwise use the voicemail in whole or in part on The Awardist podcast without restriction. Voicemails may be edited for content and or to anonymize the identity of the caller at our discretion. All information submitted in the voicemail is subject to our privacy policy, available at EW.com.